It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Charles Payne.
I'm Kat Timpf.
I'm Stuart Varney, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Wednesday, March 29th, 2023. I'm Dave Anthony. It's his latest move in his war on Ukraine. Russian leader Vladimir Putin plans to put nuclear weapons in nearby Belarus.
This is a sort of effort by him to break the will of the Ukrainian people, to convince them that their resistance is futile.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. After young children were murdered in the latest mass shooting, this one again at a school, the president called again for an assault weapons ban. But what is the future of new gun laws after a recent Supreme Court decision?
These things need to be clarified, they need to be presented clearly, and they need to be hammered out in a good faith effort, likely in Congress.
And I'm Will Kane, and I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Russia's war on Ukraine is now in its 14th month, and leader Vladimir Putin has suffered setbacks and a lot of casualties depleting Russian forces. So he is once again raising a nuclear red flag with a plan to move what are called tactical nuclear weapons into Belarus, his neighbor and ally that borders Ukraine.
These tactical nukes are disturbing.
Republican Congressman Michael McCaul chairs the House Foreign Affairs Committee and also told Fox News Sunday,
tensions are rising. I think this is saber rattling on the part of Putin to try to frighten with the operations going on.
Though Putin claims he's just following America's lead, that the U.S. already put nuclear weapons in European countries.
These are battlefield nuclear weapons. These are nuclear weapons designed to change the tempo on the ground in a conflict. So they're not a strategic threat to the United States.
Stephen Hadley is a former national security advisor and editor of the recent book, Handoff, the foreign policy George W. Bush passed to Barack Obama.
But there's certainly a potential threat for it to Ukraine and to our friends and allies in Europe. So it's something to be concerned about. Why is Putin doing this? This is a sort of effort by him to break the will of the Ukrainian people, to convince them that their resistance is futile, and break the will of the Europeans and the Americans and others, including our Asian friends and allies, who are supporting Ukraine. So this is part of his psychological warfare.
Moving them from that country, Russia, to Belarus, what does he accomplish strategically?
So Belarus from the beginning has been supportive of Russian deployments to be used in the war. But Belarus itself has not committed its own forces in the effort by Russia against Ukraine. And I think Putin is trying to draw Belarus closer and closer to the conflict. And putting tactical nuclear weapons in Belarus is one way to do that.
If one is used, what happens? Because if you use it, wouldn't it affect your own troops, too?
It's a question. One of the things you need to be careful about is, are your own troops at risk? You know, the winds in that part of the world move, of course, from west to east. So the risk is that if Russia were to use a tactical nuclear weapon, the fallout would fall upon Russian troops. And the Russian troops he's using in Ukraine are not equipped to operate in a kind of post-nuclear environment. So there's a question of how he would use them in a way that would not threaten his own troops. And there's a question of why he would use them. And one of the things he might do is if this Ukrainian counteroffensive that has been promised were to really threaten Russia's position in Ukraine, it is possible that Russia would use a tactical nuclear weapon, perhaps in a relatively uninhabited place, to signal that we were about to cross a Russian red line, if you will.
What would the U.S. have to do? What would NATO do if there was a nuclear weapon used in Ukraine? We've stayed out of it militarily other than providing weapons.
I think the administration, I'm sure, is thinking about how it would respond. I think it's unlikely that they would respond with their own nuclear capability, though, of course, there is that tactical nuclear capability, a limited tactical nuclear capability in Europe. I don't think they would respond in that way. I do think, though, there would have to be a military response. And I think it would be use of weapons and potentially even American aircraft and the like against Russian forces on the ground in Ukraine to try to shift the balance in Ukraine's favor. But this is a big move. This would cross a red line that the Biden administration has established, which is that it's fine to provide military and economic support to Ukraine, but that the Biden administration makes clear that their desire is not to have U.S. troops or U.S. military forces in Ukraine to battle Russian troops. I think that's a red line they will try to protect, but it'll be stressed if Putin were to use a tactical nuclear weapon, because I think there would be a lot of pressure to make a military response. And I suspect that the Ukrainian forces would not be sufficient to make the kind of military response that the administration might think was required. So it would pose a lot of dilemmas for the Biden administration. It would be a very difficult decision for them to make.
Not to be outdone, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un claims to also have tactical nuclear weapons, seen in a photo state media released showing him inspecting a bunch of green warheads, as North Korea also launches more missile tests, angry over ongoing U.S. and South Korean joint military exercises in a never-ending nuclear sanctions standoff.
There is no evidence that if we stopped our military exercises with our allies, that it would halt the North Korean nuclear program or its program to develop ballistic missiles. So the question is, where are we and what do we do? The strategy so far has been to enhance deterrence, to strengthen our ties with our allies in the region, to strengthen their defense capabilities, to convince them and to convince North Korea that our nuclear umbrella over South Korea and Japan is credible, and that if North Korea were to be so foolish as to use nuclear weapons against our allies in the region, there would be an overwhelming U.S. response, which would obliterate North Korea. The question is whether the South Koreans and the Japanese are going to think that's adequate, or whether this is going to provoke a renewed discussion in those countries about whether they need to develop their own nuclear weapons in order to deter North Korea. And that, of course, is a question that will then implicate China, because the last thing China would like is to have South Korea and Japan have nuclear weapons, which would be justified as deterring North Korea, but would obviously have a potential for doing something with respect to China. So this situation is troubling. We have not found over the course of almost five administrations how to roll back the North Korean nuclear program. And Kim Jong-un has made it the centerpiece of his tenure as leader of North Korea.
You know, you talk about China. It seems like almost every issue we're dealing with, China is involved in some way. Obviously, the leader, Xi Jinping, had just gone to Russia last week, and there's worry that he might provide weapons to Russia. Then you also have China still trying to work with our European allies on a trade agreement. So, and they're in Africa, investing there. Latin America, they're trying to get involved there. Everywhere we turn, there's China.
That's exactly right. They have pretensions now to be a global power and to be a predominant power on the global stage, as well as, of course, what we would call a regional hegemon in Northeast Asia. So that is the China challenge. And we are, I think, have been slow to awaken to that challenge. I think the Trump administration gets a lot of credit for waking the American people up to the challenge of China. And I think the Biden administration is working on a bipartisan basis to try to put together a strategy that the elements of which are already emerging for dealing with what is going to be a challenge from China that we're going to face for the decades ahead.
Now to Israel. And the widespread protests that pretty much shut the country down Monday. Tens of thousands out demonstrating, including many workers who went on strike, angry at Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's plan to overhaul the country's judicial system. His critics fear it'll give Netanyahu and his ruling party too much control over courts. Later that day, he relented and put the plan on hold.
When there's an opportunity to avoid civil war through dialogue, I, as prime minister, am taking a time out for dialogue.
But will that be enough to calm things down?
I think just to defer it is not enough. I think my own view, and this is Israel is a democracy, they are going to have to find their own way out from under this crisis. But my own view is they need a process of consideration of the criticisms that have been made of the existing system. It doesn't have a written constitution. Its rules about the role of judiciary are somewhat informal, if you will. They need a process by which these objections and concerns of both sides can be addressed and try to build over time a consensus as to what kind of changes are appropriate to address the grievances on both sides of this issue.
Good luck.
I think that's what they need. That's going to take some time.
I mean, they had numerous elections to try to even elect a prime minister that failed over and over again, and now it's back to Netanyahu. It's been very difficult.
It's very difficult, but one of the problems was this issue was not part of any of those election campaigns, certainly not the last one, as I understand it. It was not something that was on the agenda that Netanyahu put before the country when he entered into office. So it's come somewhat on the agenda with surprise and without preparation. And I think that accounts for the extreme reaction in the streets. And that's why I say you need a much more deliberative, transparent process where these objections and concerns can be dealt with and some consensus can be built in order for a solution if this crisis is going to be avoided.
But how does that affect us? I mean, it's political in that country, but the Middle East conflict, Israelis versus Palestinians, that seems to be the one that could grow into something larger versus the political stuff in Israel. Or am I wrong about that?
You don't like to see your close friends and allies debilitated by internal political strife. Similarly, no one wants to see the situation between Israeli settlers and the Palestinians descend again to another intifada and terrorism and loss of life on both sides. And there has been loss of life on both sides already. It's in nobody's interest for that to build because it will strain Israel's relations with its own Palestinian citizens, with its Palestinian neighbors on the West Bank, and it'll strain its relationship with the Arab countries in the Middle East who have entered into these Abraham Accords where they have recognized the state of Israel and established diplomatic relations with Israel. This is a huge breakthrough on behalf of Israeli security and Israel's position in the region. And it is put at risk if there is a new intifada and spreading violence between the Israeli security forces, Israeli settlers, and Palestinians.
Stephen Hadley, former national security advisor, editor of Handoff, the book that's the foreign policy of George W. Bush passed to Barack Obama. Thank you again for joining us.
Delighted. Thanks for having me.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Stay on top of the latest news and information from Fox News. Listen and download the Fox News Hourly Update on your time. The trending stories you need anytime you want it. Listen and download now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
This is Will Cain with your Fox News commentary coming up.
This week, there was yet another mass shooting. And again, this one was at a school, a Christian elementary school in Nashville, Tennessee. 3 9-year-old children were among those killed, along with 3 adults. The suspected shooter, a 28-year-old who went to the school there when they were younger, according to police, was killed by law enforcement. Police said the school had no officers present or assigned to it. Nashville police spokesman Don Aaron said of the shooter,
"We know that she was armed with at least 2 assault-type rifles and a handgun."
President Biden said more needs to be done to protect schools without turning them into prisons.
So I again call on Congress to pass the assault weapons ban. Pass it. It should not be a partisan issue. It's a common sense issue. We have to act now. People say, why do I keep saying this if it's not happening? Because I want you to know who isn't doing it.
But is it that simple? The Supreme Court's Bruin decision last year found New York's law that required a license to carry a concealed weapon in a public place is unconstitutional. The ruling said gun cases moving forward need to consider the historical tradition of firearms regulation. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham introduced legislation to codify that Supreme Court decision into law, along with the Heller decision, which affirmed an individual's right to keep and bear arms.
Because the Second Amendment was designed to allow people to defend themselves in dangerous situations outside their home. There's nothing in the Second Amendment about you can own a gun in your home and nowhere else.
But during a recent Judiciary Committee hearing, Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois said the Bruin decision has upended gun cases being heard in courts around the country.
Now the Supreme Court has imposed a radical new framework under Judge Thomas's decision with barely any guidance to apply it and plenty of opportunity for judges to cherry pick from history to engage in judicial activism in the name of originalism.
So then, what does all of this mean for the future of gun laws and regulations as the president calls for an assault weapons ban?
Going forward, regarding Bruin, I think we're in for some turbulent road as all of these states try to figure out how they can synchronize with the Bruin decision.
Paul Morrow is a former NYPD inspector and attorney.
There's also, though, to go to another piece, the political aspect of it, and I think that most pointedly resides in the president's use of the term assault weapon, because one of the nuances of this is that what an assault weapon actually is far from a determined fact. Most people tend to think of an assault weapon as being a fully automatic weapon, that is a machine gun. You press the trigger and it fires numerous rounds. Well, AR-15s, which the president is referring to here, and numerous people refer to as an assault weapon, doesn't operate that way. You pull the trigger once, it shoots one round. It's not you depress the trigger once and it continually fires. In fact, machine guns are very heavily regulated in this country. So the idea of quote-unquote banning assault weapons is a very pointed and likely effective political talking point. But what does that actually mean? Because if you ban AR-15s, that is a gun in which you press the trigger once and it fires one round, you are going to take a large category of similar weapons with it. And I don't believe that's the including hunting rifles and stuff. And so I don't believe that that's the intent of what he's talking about. So these things need to be clarified. They need to be presented clearly and they need to be hammered out in a good faith effort, likely in Congress.
Put on your former NYPD investigator hat here, which obviously you do multiple times, especially when we speak to you. But when the president says, you know, we need to do more to protect schools without turning them into prisons, let's talk about school security. I don't know how many times you've responded to a school or if you have, but, you know, I asked the deputy at my kid's school after the Nashville shooting, you know, what would happen if he was getting coffee or in the restroom and someone shot through our glass door? And, you know, he said there are devices in the hallway that would actually alert 911 in that event. Do we just need to rely more on tech? Is it time to spend money on additional security staffing or harden our schools in a different way?
I think it is. And I don't want to take that default response, the default solution, which so many of us are guilty of, and just saying, yeah, we need more of this, we need more of that, and being blind to the cost, right? These things can get expensive. But what I would argue, the lesson embedded in what we know so far from Nashville is that the defensive approach, the prophylactic approach, does work. And so I feel like one of the things that we could be leveraging are retired police officers to come in and potentially work in our schools to harden those places. And just the fact that they're there will have such a prophylactic effect that I think that we could potentially cut down on some of these incidents.
Wow. Finally, Paul, when you hear this shooter in Nashville was being treated for an emotional health disorder, her parents were aware of her struggles. They told her to sell her guns. Clearly, she hid some of them. I suppose no amount of money in the world can really force you to get mentally healthy. And that bipartisan Safer Communities Act signed last year, that includes millions for mental health treatment. But what do we do with this other than offer people help and hope they take it?
I know. And that's a really, really thorny issue, because what you're getting into there is a civil issue, right? And what would have had to have happened here, realistically, is the parents apparently were under the impression that she had divested herself of all of her guns. She had not. So realistically, what would you have had here? The parents would have had a committer, or they would have had to call the police and have them come to the house
and make sure of the fact that she didn't have the guns. And, you know, you get into very thorny issues of, well, what if she didn't live with the parents? And they make that call. Do the police have the power to go in there? New York has some red flag laws that allow you to do this kind of stuff. Bruin may, you know, throw them into flux as well. Look, once somebody starts shooting in a school, no matter how good your response is, you've failed. And I think that's a lesson of Nashville, because the response here from the police was quite good, and yet we have six people dead. So I think a better level of monitoring, standard protocols for response, hardening your target as much as possible, and a campaign, I think you have to, where you have to say, you know, look, folks, and this is at a nationwide level now, any doubts, call it in. And we probably do have to get to the point where, and I know it feels like people would be sort of turning on each other, but if you have a family member who has guns and you suspect that there is maybe some mental illness there, make the call, because this is not the first one of these. Remember that kid Lanza? Same thing. You know, the mother had this gun cabinet that he had access to. One look at that kid's mugshot, you can see, God bless him, that he was in real mental distress. And you have to say it was incumbent upon his mother to make that call, and she didn't.
But when it comes to the president's call for an assault weapons ban, that may depend on what side of the political aisle you're on. After the Supreme Court's Bruin decision came down, the National Shooting Sports Foundation said it applies a true reading of what the Bill of Rights tells us and does provide clarity on a fundamental right. But Chris Brown, president of the Brady Campaign Against Gun Violence, says since then, they've seen judges issue very different rulings around the country.
Post-Bruin, there's a lot of confusion about how to apply this rather complex standard, and a lot of thought from advocates like me, a lot of head scratching about how this could possibly be a workable standard in the 21st century.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. So I was reading, you know, one judge in Delaware said this new test to apply, thanks to Bruin, means a ghost gun law banning their manufacture and possession cannot stand. But a judge in California rejected a challenge to their ghost gun law. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down a law that said you can't have a gun if you have a domestic violence restraining order against you. So regardless of how you feel politically about firearms, this sounds messy. What do you foresee in terms of, I guess, would this have to come before the court in the form of another case regarding firearms?
Yes, and I think it will. You mentioned this Fifth Circuit case, and for your listeners, that's a case where it was recently held that a law that's been in effect for a while and is quite important, a judge in the Fifth Circuit, which is a federal district court, said, well, actually, now I'm looking at that law and applying the Bruin decision, which has these new factors which require me to look back in history and understand whether there was a corollary to this law in effect in colonial times. And I'm finding that there wasn't. And therefore, I'm going to hold a law that says domestic violence abusers should have their guns removed. I'm going to hold that as unconstitutional, which I think is not a good standard.
Chris, what does all of this mean when we hear the president say, hey, Congress, it's time for an assault weapons ban? We all remember, well, not all of us, but most of us remember the last assault weapons ban expired in 2004. There were challenges to that at that time. How different would an assault weapons ban or any congressional gun law be in the context of these recent Supreme Court decisions, including maybe even Heller, which is more than a decade old now?
Like a piece of wood in a buzzsaw? I mean, that's kind of what they have set up for themselves in terms of the constitutionality of any law with respect to the Second Amendment. And let me just be clear, when the Supreme Court decided the Bruin opinion, it was not setting a standard of judicial review, right? And when I say that, what I mean is the lens pursuant to which every court in the country has to review a law. Before the Bruin decision, our laws around the Second Amendment would be reviewed with a balancing test. What's the interest of public safety? Let me counter that by understanding the origins of the Second Amendment, and does this infringe the Second Amendment? That was the standard of review for 200 years, up until the Bruin decision, right? And the Bruin decision said, no, 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 no. we have to look at this three-pronged test, and the one that is really challenging is there a historical corollary to this law in colonial times? And that will be right up front for Roberts to consider in this next session. And I don't envy that task. I think it's a tough one, but I hope that they reframe this because it's the only amendment to the Constitution that we actually have this test for.
Finally, Chris, the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, right, signed last summer by the president, it allotted more money, among other things, for mental health programs. The parents in this particular case of the Nashville shooter told police that she'd been under mental health care for an emotional disorder. They had her sell her weapons, but she clearly hid some. I wonder if this points out the cracks that rules can fall through. You know, should these parents have called law enforcement or filed an order with a court?
Honestly, it just breaks my heart as a mother of a 21-year-old and 19-year-old. These parents were in a tough position. And the reason why is because Tennessee has not passed an extreme risk protection law. You referenced the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. That's the federal law that incented states. Hey, Tennessee, we will give you free money to implement this law, to make sure that parents with kids who are at risk, that they are able to take action and remove guns and put these individuals in the background check system. That's how that law works. Tennessee does not have that law. And unfortunately, based on our current system, I would say there's almost nothing available to these parents to meaningfully remove guns from their 28-year-old daughter.
Chris Brown, president of United Against Gun Violence at the Brady Center, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
And in other news,
I'm Gianna Gelosi. Residents of Greenland spring forward for the last time. While the U.S. and Europe debate about whether to stick to the twice-yearly clock switching, Greenland's parliament voted to stick to daylight saving time year-round. Officials say it's going to give Greenlanders another hour of daylight in the afternoons, more time to do business with Europe and the rest of the world, and, quote, an opportunity to slow down in a fast-paced world. Geographically, sparsely populated Greenland belongs to the North American continent, but geopolitically, it's in Europe. Earlier this month, a bipartisan group of U.S. senators reintroduced legislation to make daylight saving time permanent here in the U.S. after it unanimously passed the upper chamber last year, but failed to get a vote in the House, because lawmakers couldn't agree on whether to keep standard time or permanent daylight saving time. Since 2015, about 30 states have introduced legislation to end the twice-yearly changing of the clocks. For the Fox News Rundown, I'm Gianna Gelosi.
New from the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Dana Perino. Join me for season 3 of my limited time podcast, Everything Will Be Okay, based on my best-selling book of the same name. Make sure you subscribe to this series wherever you download podcasts and leave a rating and review.
Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary. Will Kane. What's on your mind?
There is so much to discuss. When once again, some deviant, deranged individual steps inside of a school and kills America's children. Audrey Hale did so at the Covenant Christian School in Nashville, Tennessee, killing 3 children and 3 adults. And we can have plenty of conversations around the cultural movement of this person. But for today, I want to celebrate some real men. The Nashville, Tennessee Police Department covered itself in glory in the wake of this tragedy. If you haven't, go wherever you need to go. Watch it. The body cam footage from officers like Rex Engelbert and Michael Collazo. These officers arrived on the scene and within 4 minutes had taken down Audrey Hale. You can watch as Engelbert competently, confidently goes room to room, hallway to hallway, clearing that building. You'll be reminded of leadership, real leadership, when you listen to Collazo calmly tell his teammates, go, 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 lead with your rifle, I'm with you, to the right, keep pushing. Throughout the 3 minutes it takes these men to arrive at the second floor, No hesitation going through any door. No pause coming around any corner until Engelbert is the first to go around that last corner and take down Audrey Hale. It is an amazing testament to the values of real men. If you want to hear more, check out the Will Cain podcast on Fox News Podcast. Download, rate, and review wherever you get your audio entertainment.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.